This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
All of this increases the risk of not being able to reach children in time. If we can't reach children in time, then there's a greatly increased risk of those children dying.
That was UNICEF's own Watkinson, Sudan, on the impact of conflict on children who have become refugees with little access to food and other necessities. Details coming up also. Nigeria prepares to inaugurate its new president, and DRC President Felix Tshisekedi starts a five-day visit to China today. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Sudan's latest ceasefire attempt appeared to be crumbling today, with clashes between rival military factions breaking out in several parts of the capital, Khartoum. Like previous efforts to stop the fighting that began April 15th, each side accuses the other of ceasefire violations. Experts have said the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, led by former allies, both believe they can win and will not stop till it is clear that one side has a clear advantage. A seven-day ceasefire was supposed to start Monday night, 2 days after a deal was reached in negotiations brokered by the United States and Saudi Arabia in an effort for a temporary halt in the fighting so residents can flee and aid agencies can get humanitarian aid to the needy. More than 1.1 million people already have fled their homes, and more than 300,000 have gone to neighboring countries, some of which are similarly impoverished and have a history of internal conflict. The United Nations Human Rights Chief, Volker Turk, today described the situation in Sudan as heartbreaking and made a direct call to the two warring generals to stop sexual violence and spare the lives of civilians.
We see how civilians continue to be exposed to serious risk of death and injury. I mean, overnight we received reports of fighter jets across Khartoum and clashes in some areas of the city, as well as gunfire heard Khartoum North and in Omdurman.
The UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk was speaking from Geneva. The United Nations Children's Fund recently said Sudan's war has displaced at least 450,000 children from their homes, with tens of thousands fleeing into neighboring countries. Aid groups say these refugee children are being deprived of education, which puts them at higher risk for exploitation, child marriage, and recruitment into armed groups. Henry Wilkins has more on the story from Borota, Chad, near the border with Sudan.
As tens of thousands of refugees arrive across the border from Sudan into Chad, much of the international assistance offered by the UN and aid groups has focused on water, food and other basic services to refugees. But refugees like 18-year-old Abdel Nasser Mohammed says there is desperate need for education too. His hopes of going to university have been dashed by Sudan's civil war, which started on April 15th, triggering intercommunal violence in his hometown in West Darfur. He had to flee to Chad without his parents. He says his mum and dad had to go to Khartoum to get medical treatment. They are now stuck there because of the conflict and couldn't come with him to Chad. He arrived with only his siblings. Mohammed says he has not heard from his parents in weeks and does not know if they're alive or dead. He now lives in this tiny makeshift shelter with his brothers and sisters and says there is no way to take his Sudanese university entrance exams. Malek Mohammed, a teacher who has just fled to Chad from West Darfur, laments the squalid conditions that the children he used to teach are now forced to live in. He says all students, pupils and teachers are now living in the refugee camp. But this is not the right environment for education, and it's hugely challenging, especially in the long term. If we're forced to stay here for a long period, he says, there'll be no learning, which causes problems in society later on. Mohammed says teachers are trying to work out a way for children to take Sudanese exams in Chad. The government in Khartoum has ceased to function since the civil war started, so coordination looks unlikely. Education Cannot Wait, ECW, is the United Nations Fund for Education in Times of Crisis. The organisation's director, Yasmin Sharif, made a visit to Chad in May, pledging $3 million to Chad for educational needs. She was asked why she thinks it's necessary to support education, even when the need for basics like food and water is so high.
Empower them to raise up of the ashes of that suffering. You don't empower them with water and food. These are necessities, but that alone is not going to empower them and prevent them from all the protection challenges, such as gender-based violence, sexual abuse, getting into armed groups, and certainly not giving them any hope for the future.
Sudan's war's impact on children is not confined to education. The UN announced on May 12th that a Sudanese factory producing 60% of specialised food used to treat child malnutrition in the country was destroyed in the fighting. Owen Watkins of UNICEF Sudan tells VOA.
All of this increases the risk of not being able to reach children in time. If we can't reach children in time, then there's a greatly increased risk of those children dying.
As for Mohammed, he says, the war has had a massive impact on his plans, and he now feels the dreams he has had since childhood will go unrealized. Tens of thousands of Sudanese children will find themselves in the same situation. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Barotta, Chad.
The families of prominent detained Tunisian opposition figures, including opposition leader Rachid Ghannouchi, are calling on the international community to pressure President Kais Saied's government to release political detainees and end the crackdown on freedom of expression. From the Kenyan capital Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports for VOA.
The families of five prominent Tunisian detainees and one deceased opposition member went to Arusha, Tanzania, Wednesday to file petitions at the African Court of Human and People's Rights against the Tunisian government. Speaking to VOA in Nairobi Tuesday, the family members urged the international community to impose sanctions on Tunisian government officials, including President Kais Saied, over what they call gross human rights violations. Yusra Ghannouchi is the daughter of opposition leader Rachid Ghannouchi, who has been in prison since April 17th.
Sadly, after a revolution and after 10 years of a democratic transition, with its ups and downs, we have been living now for almost 2 years through a coup perpetrated by Kais Saied against Tunisia's democracy, trying to use the judiciary to eliminate anyone who criticizes him.
The petition asks for urgent provisional measures ordering the government to immediately release political detainees, including our father and other prominent political figures. Tunisia is one of only six African countries that have fully signed up to the court. This means Tunisians can directly apply to the court.
And that's why we are coming to seek justice by filing a petition on behalf of our fathers and other political detainees in Tunisia, because Tunisia is a member of the African Court and its rulings are binding on Tunisia. And we hope it will rule to end the plight that our parents are subjected to.
Kauthar Farijani, the daughter of detained opposition parliamentarian Saied Farijani, spoke about the political situation in the country.
Currently, the situation in Tunisia has been deteriorating rapidly ever since the coup. The crackdowns have gone beyond the main prominent political opposition. Now it's for anyone who criticizes either the regime or anything around the regime. So we have everyone from bloggers to an average citizen who posts a Facebook post, all have been targeted by the current regime.
She also said she feared for her father's safety.
My father himself, he's actually been sent to prison until they find evidence. He is 68 years old. He has ailments from torture that he received under the Bin Ali regime. He's in an overcrowded cell. It has a capacity of 60, and he's with 120 people. He has also received death threats in prison.
In July 2021, President Saeed suspended parliament and dissolved the government, a move his opponents call a constitutional coup. He also dismissed dozens of judges. Saeed has justified his actions as an effort to end what he called political paralysis and corruption. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Bola Tinubu, a political godfather famed for his strategic deftness and clout, won a tight race to succeed Muhammadu Buhari as the next president of Nigeria. He will be sworn in next Monday. Elliot Masote, professor of business at Devry University in the U.S. state of Ohio, in talking to me says Tinubu should focus on the poor, concentrate on building strong communities, and above all, invest in education.
The incoming president, and I think looking at his age and looking at African politics in general, the way we lean more to people who have been there, because they are part of the old system that has been there, I don't think it's a good thing for Nigeria, for Africa in general, not to support younger candidates, because we look at Africa as a continent that has the most young people in the whole world, whom, you know, we trust the old people to lead us. What new ideas do they have at that age? Of course, we know some people will say, oh, what about the USA with an 8-year-old president? But we have to look into the constitution of a country like the United States versus our constitutions in Africa, where the president, African president, will have all the powers, you know, to do whatever he wants. And one
thing, Professor, there is a court case not been rectified, and people are saying maybe the swearing in should be postponed until the court comes up with a decision.
In terms of inaugurating the president, they have to follow the constitution. And you know, if something is not going to be done in the court to end that argument, I think there should be a provision in the constitution for them to go ahead and install the new president. Because you look at the whole of Africa, it's not easy for losing candidates, even if they know that they have lost. In most cases, they always argue and they always say we haven't won, always go to court, because they already know the final judgment that the opposition may not win the is not going to win the appeal. So in terms of judging whether it is a good thing to wait until the court case is concluded, it depends with the Nigerian constitution. What does it say? Because the constitution is, you know, the supreme law of the land.
And lastly, Professor, you know, the 80-year-old Buhari's 2 4-year terms have left many disappointed. The security, Boko Haram, the economy. What should Mr. Tinubu do differently when he assumes power and moves forward?
Well, you know, the best thing that I advise presidents to do is really to focus on the poor, because throughout, you know, the whole world of developed countries, consumer confidence is key. And that's what we miss in most cases in Africa, where wealth will only circulate, you know, in the hands of the few who are already rich, forgetting the poor. Coming up with programs that support the poor people so that they do not flock into cities where there is nothing, you know, going there to search for jobs where there are no jobs. Concentrate on building strong communities. Where communities are strong, you know, the whole country's economy is going to be strong. But that's not the case in Africa. And I hope the Nigerian president is going to refocus the attention of the government to rural communities, the poor people, uplift the youth, invest more in education, teaching kids from primary school, from kindergarten preschool, what the economy is all about, so that each and every Nigerian, each and every African will be able to know how to build their own individual economies. Those individual economies put together, there will be a strong economy for Nigeria and Africa in general.
That was Elliot Masote, professor of business at Devery University in Ohio. He was speaking with me from Harare, Zimbabwe. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Felix Tshisekedi, today starts a five-day visit to China and, according to media reports, is expected to meet President Xi Jinping to review and sign several key trade deals. A meeting could pave the way for the two countries to formally overhaul and seal a $6 billion infrastructure for minerals deal with Chinese investors. Mulengwa Zinindura is the president of the Center for Political and Strategic Studies in the DRC. He was also the spokesperson for former President Joseph Kabila. He tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that the visit is important for the DRC.
Well, I think diplomatically that's an important trip for him. To be able to travel to China and do whatever he needs to be doing there diplomatically. I think this trip has political, economic, and diplomatic objectives for him. So I think that is very important for him.
There's talk of the $1 billion minerals for infrastructure deal. How do you assess that one?
Well, it would not be the first time the Democratic Republic of Congo gets into such a deal. I mean, deals with China, economic deals about infrastructures and so on and so forth with the Chinese. Tshisekedi's predecessor also had a deal with the Chinese. And so I do not have the details of what's going to go on with this trip, but I think the Democratic Republic of Congo has no other recourse but to do this type of trips because many Western leaders have promised the Democratic Republic of Congo or tried to work with them to do some work to rebuild infrastructures and so on and so forth. They have not come through, so it's completely understandable that the current president of the DRC would undertake such efforts to try to deal with the Chinese to develop some of the infrastructure.
The DRC has had, as you say, good relations with China for a long time, but so have they with the West, especially the United States. Would these relationships conflict in your view, or is okay?
No, there is absolutely no problem. I think a country has to choose its course as who to deal with. The Democratic Republic of Congo looks to the United States as the country where we can learn a lot of things about human rights, about the democratic process, about how to have an inclusive political system in our own country. So our country is very close to the United States. They have been for many years. So are they to the Chinese. I mean, they've learned a lot of things from the Chinese. So, these are not conflicting relationships, not at all.
Talking of the infrastructure of minerals deal, there are people who have concerns about the environment and the non-transparency of the impact assessment. Do you think the government of DRC has done its due diligence?
It's very difficult for me to say what they have done, but the relationship between China and the DRC on these issues of infrastructures, goes back quite a few years back. So I don't know what kind of due diligence has done and so on and so forth. Yeah, of course, we should all be concerned about the environment. But I think right now China is the only country giving an alternative to Congo to build their infrastructure. Western countries have not come through with the promises. So it's completely normal for the DRC to do this. There is a lot of criticism, obviously, but is there somebody who has a better proposal or suggestion for the Democratic Republic of Congo? Is there somebody else who would have a better deal with the DRC? If there is somebody who has a better deal with the DRC, I think it would be good for them to come and bring that deal to the table and see what to do. But just complaining without giving a solution is not constructive.
That was Mulengwa Zihindura, president of the Center for Political and Strategic Studies in the DRC, speaking with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. Africans around the globe celebrate African Day tomorrow, commemorating the founding of the first Union of African Countries in 1963. The theme this year for the African Union is Acceleration of the African Continental Free Trade Area Implementation. To find out more about the African Union's achievements and challenges, again, we have VOA's Douglas Mpuga. He reached David Monda, Professor of Political Science at the City University of New York.
The achievements, one is to create a general framework upon which to unite the continent. I think also to have Africa speak with one voice on its political, economic, and socio-cultural issues. And then the third one is to extend the vision of the framers of the AU Charter to fight for Africa's economic, political, and socioeconomic emancipation. But I think the other challenge is that we've really lacked structures, strong institutional structures for the AU to actually get what we need advanced. So here, for example, I'm talking about issues like the Pan-African Parliament, which is below the African Union Heads of States meeting and the AU Secretariat, the AU Commission. But then the other challenge then is also Africa has not been able to fix its own disputes. For example, our wars, our numerous wars, civil strife. So thinking, for example, of the latest in Sudan, a lot of these situations right now, for example, are being settled in Jeddah or in foreign capitals, which is a real embarrassment to the AU. Or if you think about the crisis in Ethiopia, where the AU sits, the crisis with Tigray, Africa was very much held hostage. So I think there's those opportunities for things that have been successful, but there's also a lot of ground to be covered, particularly with the institutional building, with the funding of the AU, but also in terms of creating that framework to sort Africa's problems on through frameworks of governance, the rule of law, and also democracy.
And, where do you see the AU in the short and medium term? Where is it heading?
I think in the short term, the AU will continue to suffer from major problems of lack of unity. And I say this, you know, in this very unfortunate and embarrassing context where it seems our leaders are more concerned about problems abroad than our own problems at home. And the example I'm giving here, for example, is the recent move by the President of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, to lead a delegation of six other African states to try and sort out the war in Europe, in Ukraine, when very little has been done in Africa to actually sort out our own problems and the more numerous wars on the continent. This is something that's very problematic, because why would you want to sort out, you know, a flame in your neighbor's building when your own building is burning to the ground? I think that's one very difficult and challenging thing. We really need a reorientation. But I think in the long term, on a positive note, I think that vision is still there of how will Africa integrate. And I think the Africa Free Continental Trade Agreement, I think, is one of the success areas, something to look forward to, of how we bring African countries together economically. The Yamoussoukro Accord, the Open Skies agenda, where we're trying to consolidate African airspace and airlines so that they're more efficient. Not every country just has its own airline, but we are thinking of ways to scale our comparative advantages. But I think there's also other great opportunities, particularly when you think about migration, how we encourage the brain gain rather than the brain drain of encouraging diasporans to go back to Africa, but also to encourage and reduce non-tariff barriers between African states. So I think there's a lot of hope, but there's also still a lot of work to be done.
That was David Monda, Professor of Political Science at City University of New York. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from New York. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Beckford, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.